Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Eric Siegel, professor of law at Georgia State University, and we're discussing George Fletcher's book, Our Secret Constitution. Eric, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here.
Could you begin by giving the listener a couple of minutes summary of what you take the main themes of Our Secret Constitution to be?
Sure. Professor Fletcher's book is really a provocative and well-written exploration of what he calls the secret constitution. And his claim, his overall claim, is essentially that after the Civil War, when the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution were enacted, this country entered into a second major stage of its history with what he refers to as the secret constitution. He argues that the original Constitution of 1787 was concerned primarily with freedom. The Civil War amendments, he claims, were concerned with three major values: equality, nationhood, and democracy. He argues the original founding fathers were interested in creating a structure to preserve private property and elitist decision-making. He doesn't criticize that. He just talks about that as an historical fact. Whereas the Civil War amendments, together with the Gettysburg Address, which he analogizes to the Declaration of Independence, were about equality, expanding the right to vote, the franchise, and coming together as a nation. And just, you know, quick summary, the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, basically gave people the rights of due process and equal protection. They abolished slavery, and they gave African Americans the right to vote. Unfortunately, according to Professor Fletcher, the Supreme Court of the late 1800s, after the Civil War, was mired in the old Constitution and the values of freedom, and refused for a long period of time to accept these relatively new concepts of equality, nationhood, and democracy. And perhaps the most prominent example of that, of course, is Plessy versus Ferguson, where the court upheld segregation in public transportation. Professor Fletcher argues that over time, we have done better in recognizing the values of the secret constitution, and the court of the 20th century did a lot better, but he argues we have not gone nearly far enough. His overall thesis, which I do find to be interesting, is that we really have two constitutions, not one.
What, in your reading, do you see as the strengths of this book?
Professor Fletcher writes extremely well, and for the most part, his book is transparent, which always makes for good reading. I'm a law professor, of course, and I don't think I'm going out on a limb by suggesting that many of my colleagues write in styles that are not necessarily accessible, or in fact, I would even say just poor writing. Professor Fletcher writes very clearly, and that's the strength of the book. He also gives a extremely detailed historical, and by that I mean law professor historical, view of the Civil War amendments and the Gettysburg Address. And anyone interested in that period of time in our country's history would really enjoy this book. He has a very different perspective on that time period, and I think it's interesting. His thesis that we have two constitutions, not one, and that this country embraced an entirely new set of commitments after the Civil War is provocative. And in my opinion, that thesis is worthy of further discussion, and I'm sure it will be discussed in the future. He also tackles a number of controversial topics, such as affirmative action, hate speech laws, and state statutes prohibiting felons from voting. Anyone interested in those topics would find the Secret Constitution an interesting read. And I think, finally, there is an afterword in the book about the disputed election of 2000. And although that, we've talked a lot about that, we mean our culture and society, I think his thoughts about it are interesting. And again, anybody interested in what happened with Gore and Bush would find the book fascinating.
What about the weaknesses of the book as you perceive them?
I think many of his arguments are difficult to sustain, both on a kind of a micro and macro level. His facts sometimes don't lead up to the conclusions he reaches. For example, to to support his thesis that we have and we share a national commitment to equality, democracy, and nationhood, he cites the Prohibition Amendment as an attempt to protect the weak and the vulnerable. He makes the Prohibition Amendment the best it can be, so to speak. I am skeptical that is what Prohibition was all about. I think he uses those facts to support an argument and does not do so persuasively. He also believes that his descriptive account of the values underlying the secret Constitution lead inevitably and to the conclusion that this country is wrong and many of the states in this country err when it denies felons the right to vote. He takes a very strong stance on that. I don't think he makes a compelling case for that position, and he goes through it fairly rapidly. It's my opinion that a civil, democratic, just society is well within its rights to make a contract with its citizens. If you violate certain important laws, you forfeit your right to participate in our political system. So don't violate those laws. Now, I think there are counterarguments, but Professor Fletcher never really hits those arguments head on. So I think there are some specific flaws with some of his specific arguments. On a larger level, I don't totally buy into Professor Fletcher's descriptive account of America, either back in 1865 or today. Just taking today, I think there is a strong belief in this country in equality and nationhood and democracy, certainly. But even despite September 11th, we still place a strong premium on liberty and freedom. And the values of liberty and freedom often conflict with the value of equality. There are many controversial and difficult topics where those values clash. For example, land use regulation and hate speech laws. I'm not sure where the country comes down on these questions, and I think he assumes this country is strongly on the equality side of that equation, and I'm not sure he makes that case. Finally, I think the biggest weakness of the book is that, especially for being a law professor, Professor Fletcher is unclear on how he views the role of the United States Supreme Court. At times, he implies that he is in favor of a reduced role for the court because he thinks the court gets in the way of many of his political goals. The problem is he applauds a lot of activist decisions by the court, and I think it's hard to have it both ways. And I think he does seem to fluctuate between favoring a activist court and favoring a passive court, depending on his own political agenda. And I'll just give a quick example. He strongly wants the court to invalidate state laws that restrict felons from voting, even though the text of the 14th Amendment seems to support those restrictions. But he doesn't want the court to invalidate affirmative action statutes, even though arguably those statutes contradict the clear text of the 14th Amendment. So I think he's trying to have it both ways, depending on his own short-term political agenda. And I think law professors have a higher obligation than that. But that's not to say that the book is not a fascinating read, which raises many provocative issues in a clear fashion.
All right, let's talk about each of those points that you raise, those criticisms you have of his book. The first concerns several particular arguments that he gives that you think are incomplete. Now, I'll confess up front that I was certainly taken aback when I read his description of Prohibition as somehow indicating a commitment to equality. Though I, like you, am inclined to think that's not right, it was an interesting interpretation, and I haven't yet entirely written it off. But the second one about convicts forfeiting their right to vote. In fact, there's an important distinction to be made, and I think he makes it, though he doesn't make a whole lot to do of it, between saying that a person who is imprisoned no longer has a right to vote while they are imprisoned, and the other question about whether someone who, once they have been imprisoned, should forever lose their right to vote, which in fact is the case, I believe, in about 35 states in the country now, that once you have been a convicted felon, you may never have the right to vote again, unless you're given some sort of special dispensation by the governor.
He makes that distinction, although it's not clear to me he's in favor even of the first.
No, I think you're right. But do you have the same feeling about the second that you do about the first? That someone who's once they've been convicted felon should lose their right to vote forever?
I think it's a fair question. And my answer might end up being a frustrating one. I don't know where I come out on that. Were I voting in a state legislature to take a stand on that position? It might depend, frankly, on the crime rate in my state and how many, not that I think it's a deterrent necessarily, but it might depend on the fact-specific situation in my state. Where I will tell you, though, is that to me is not an issue for the courts. In other words, if Alabama decided to do that and Tennessee did not, I would say that is perfectly reasonable. The Constitution, to me, does not clearly speak out against that prohibition in terms of any kind of equal protection analysis I'd be willing to live with. The difference between Professor Fletcher and I is not that I think necessarily it's a good policy idea and he doesn't. I honestly don't know enough about it to make a policy decision. What I do feel strongly about is that I know no theory of constitutional interpretation that I'm willing to live with that would allow the Supreme Court to invalidate those kinds of statutes. So I kind of ducked your question, but kind of didn't.
Okay. All right. Second issue concerns what you call the descriptive account, which turns out, I think you're absolutely right. In some ways, the core of the book is trying to spell out what he sees as the implications of this new commitment to equality as compared to freedom. Now, do you read him as saying that we're no longer interested in freedom?
No, I don't. And if that was his position, I think the book would be far less interesting because I don't think it's a sustainable position. I think he thinks we're far less interested in freedom than we once were. And I think he thinks we're far more interested in equality compared to freedom than we once were. I think that those are his major points. Now, at times, the rhetoric of the book, I think, you know, it's fair. It's a fair question you ask because the rhetoric of the book at times implies that freedom is this long-lost concept that no longer rears its head. But he's smarter than that, and I don't think the book fairly read takes that position. But I think it's a relative question to him.
Okay. Let me bring up one example, which now that I think about it, I'm not sure he... surely he mentions it, though I can't remember exactly where at this point, but I don't know that he spends a lot of time on it. But the issue, for instance, of the Americans with Disabilities Act, though this was something done by Congress and not done by the Supreme Court, it strikes me he might say that's a symbol of our commitment to equality over against freedom. That in order to make opportunities for someone who's handicapped means that we do have to place some kind of limits.
I think he does say that. I think that is accurate, and it's not just the Americans with Disability Act. I think all of our employment discrimination laws obviously favor equality over freedom. Someone living in 1804, of course, would probably take the position, if I own a company of 1,000 people, don't tell me who I have to hire and who I don't. It's my freedom to hire and fire who I want. And, of course, we don't believe that anymore, I think for all the right reasons. I agree with all of the employment discrimination laws. And that's an example where our notion of equality certainly trumps our notion of freedom, and in my opinion, correctly so. But that brings us back to one of the weaknesses of the book, though. I think his descriptive account of legislatures, although with some flaws, is not a bad one. And I think certainly on the national level, our national legislature is generally more concerned these days with equality than freedom, and that's true for many states. It's not true in the state I live in, for example, in Georgia, but it's true for many, many states. However, where his descriptive account gets confusing is what role he wants the court to play in that balance. And because the court has, Supreme Court and federal courts in general, have played such a large role in promoting both freedom and equality over the years, that weakness makes it difficult to understand some of his political arguments. would he want the court to enforce the idea of an Americans with Disability Act under the Equal Protection Clause if that statute hadn't been passed? I think the answer is maybe. Yet, he seems to suggest he wants a reduced role for the court. That confusion runs throughout the book and frankly, confuses me in general.
Okay, I want to continue on both of these themes. In the second half of the show, I'd like to pause just for a moment. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Eric Siegel, professor of law at Georgia State University, and we're discussing George Fletcher's book, Our Secret Constitution. I want to ask you one more question again about this, the issue of freedom and equality, and then I want to talk about the idea of the activist court, which you also addressed just a moment ago. Would it be fair to say from your reading then that the flaw as you see it in his book is not that he doesn't deny that freedom is important, he acknowledges it's important. The flaw may be in perhaps thinking that equality has completely trumped freedom in a way that you think it hasn't, both in the American mindset, in legislatures, and in the Supreme Court.
I think you started that question with the major flaw in the book. So I'm not sure that's the major flaw in the book. First of all, I think Professor Fletcher makes a lot of compelling arguments as to why in the year 2000, I think he wrote the book in 2001, why maybe freedom should trump equality. I'm sorry, equality should trump freedom in many ways. I think he makes a strong argument, and one that I am, frankly, politically sympathetic towards. I think it's good when law professors or any writers come out with their biases fairly on the table, and he does that. And he says, I think equality is far more important than freedom. We live in a country with great inequality, political and economic and racial, and he's certainly right about that from my political perspective. And he thinks we should change that, and I applaud that effort. The major flaw in the book, not to sound like a broken record, but the major flaw in the book to me is not allocating to each of our major political institutions what role they should play in that fight. And I'll just give you an example from my own political views to contrast what he does. Were I going to write a book about freedom and equality, I would make it very clear that my take on American history is that the Supreme Court more often than not gets in the way of leftist political causes, and therefore equality. I think over time, the Supreme Court, from the year 1787 to today, over time, almost always favors equality. Since I have different political values than that, I argue for a very reduced role for the court across the board.
I'm sorry, you say they favor equality or favor freedom?
I'm sorry, you corrected me correctly. They favor freedom.
Okay.
Thank you. And since I, with Professor Fletcher, favor the equality side of the scale, I argue in my writing for a very reduced role for the Supreme Court. And I'm consistent about that. I know I'll take some hits. I know sometimes I'll lose. But over time, the Supreme Court will do more what I want it to do if it is a very deferential court. Professor Fletcher does not discuss what he wants the Supreme Court to do over time, other than on each specific issue. I think that's the major flaw of the book.
Okay, and I know this is your area of concern is constitutional law, in particular judicial review. So I can well see why this would bother you. I'm wondering, though, I mean, I'm just trying to go back now and to remember some bits of the argument in the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm guessing that if he were here and he heard you say, well, look, I want a more clearly defined role for each area. I want the legislature to do this, the Supreme Court to do that, that he might well reject that outright. That in his view, I suppose, when he thinks about what happened in the Civil War, that the changes that were brought about, and again, he thinks they were very profound changes, weren't clearly traceable to any one of the elements. It wasn't just to the American people. It wasn't just by the courts. It wasn't just by the legislature. But somehow this interesting amalgamation of them all. And in fact, that the Civil War, literally fighting and spilling blood, somehow was an integral element of this change. So I'm not sure that's adequate in general. I'm not sure that you'd find it adequate, but that's one of the things that's very odd about the book and intriguing about the book is that I don't think he has, or offers at least here, a clear division of labor about who can and can't do what.
I think that's right, and I think if he were here, he might take the position that Professor Fletcher, have a certain set of commitments that are extremely important, most of them revolving around equality values. That's the major issue facing this country. And, you know, I don't care how we get there, but here, you know, I think affirmative action is good. I think denying felons the right to vote is bad. I think hate speech laws are bad. And let me just say one thing about that, because we haven't hit on that yet, but I think it's, and we're running out of time, and I think it's an interesting part of the book. I think Professor Fletcher is not a strong First Amendment proponent. And I think he comes across pretty clearly on that. You know, the First Amendment is usually for people with money. People with money get to speak. And people without money don't get to speak. And I think he undervalues the importance of free speech relative to democracy. Now, he does several times in the book bracket that issue and suggest it's complicated and difficult, and he's not tackling it head on. But for someone who is such a strong advocate of equality over freedom, I think that raises a number of difficult First Amendment questions that perhaps he should have tackled. But going back to the original question that you asked, we as a society have to decide who gets to decide whether affirmative action statutes stay on the books. We as a society have to decide who gets to decide whether hate speech laws stay on the books. And any treatment of these questions, and the problem is he treats these questions. He talks about affirmative action for 10, 15 pages. To talk about affirmative action, but then leave open the implications for the court's role in invalidating affirmative action statutes, to me, is only half the discussion. And I'd like to think it's not because my particular area of interest is judicial review. It's because the question of who decides is just a very fundamental one. And I don't think he treats that as exhaustively as he should.
Okay. Let me ask you, you've used the phrase judicial activism here. I wonder if you could explain exactly what you mean by that phrase.
I will, and it's a good question. Alexander Hamilton view judicial review in the following way. The only time the court would step in and invalidate an act of the legislature would be when there was what he called irreconcilable variance between that statute and the Constitution. In other words, plainly unconstitutional. The Constitution requires the president to be 35. If we pass the law allowing a 32-year-old president, Alexander Hamilton would have said that's unconstitutional and should be struck down. Of course, we are nowhere near that type of judicial review in this country. And the Supreme Court frequently and without any second thoughts invalidates acts of state legislatures and the Congress, and in recent years, especially the Congress, where, frankly, the constitutional issue is unsettled. Someone in favor of judicial activism, as Professor Fletcher, I think, is, would say that's fine, that there should be some deference given to the legislature. But if the court has a reasonable good faith belief that something legislature has done is unconstitutional, they should invalidate it. Someone who believes in judicial deference, like I do, would argue no. It really has to be clear. And I'll say something controversial about that. I am completely and obviously and totally in favor of desegregated public schools in every possible way, and you know, I'm a left-wing Democrat in how I vote. Brown versus Board of Education is a very difficult Supreme Court decision to sustain under a theory of constitutional interpretation that I'm willing to live with. And, you know, I think the spirit behind Brown led to the spirit behind Roe versus Wade. And someone who believes in judicial activism could very easily favor both decisions. Someone in favor of judicial deference, frankly, would have a hard time with both decisions. And that's the difference.
Okay. What exactly does one defer?
One defers to the people acting through their elected representatives. But let me say something. Let me be upfront about something. I don't take my position because of a principled stance on my view on the allocation of power in a just democratic society. I wish I could say that I did. I do not. My view is a political one. I'm a left-wing Democrat, and in my view, my political agenda will be furthered tremendously if over the course of time the Supreme Court lets the legislature do its work, unless it is at an irreconcilable variance with the Constitution.
Okay. Let me just ask one follow-up question there, because we are getting out of time. I mean, there's something incredibly intriguing about this view, because standardly one hears more people with more conservative or right-wing tendencies criticizing an activist court. And
not anymore. I'm sorry. I mean, not anymore. Not really. The truth is, until the Warren Court, the right wing was almost always in favor of judicial activism, and the left wing was almost always not in favor of it. The court invalidated economic legislation throughout the 1800s, throughout the early 20th century. Throughout most of this country's history, the right has favored an activist court. It is only with the Warren Court where that changed.
Okay.
And most law professors grew up in that era. 20 years from now, and maybe even 10 years from now, most leftists will want a deferential court, and that's already happening. One quick example, Mark Tushnet, who's a radical, radical leftist at Georgetown, one of the great constitutional law scholars in this country, he's more than a liberal Democrat, he's a radical leftist. He's in favor of abolishing judicial review. And that's happening all over the place.
Okay. So what you're wanting to say is that the impression that conservatives are opposed to judicial activism is, in fact, a phenomenon that occurred really within about a 20-year period, 20, 25-year period, in the, I suppose, the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
Early 80s. Okay.
Yeah.
So to that extent, someone like Bork would be something of an unusual bird, because he claimed to be both very conservative and claimed to be interested in simply looking at the original intent of the Constitution.
Which, by the way, he doesn't do. But look at original intent. I mean, but leaving that aside, that's right. a different program.
Right.
No, I think in 1986, when his confirmation, when his confirmation was at issue, over the 80s and the 90s, the legal academy was still responding to the activist Warren Court. So most conservatives would say they were in favor of judicial deference during that time period. That is changing now, and I think and with the Rehnquist Court especially, invalidating acts of Congress left and right in the name of federalism, it is really changing. And now many, many left-wing scholars are advocating a reduced role for the court, and many right-wing scholars are quietly not objecting. I wouldn't say they're supporting it, but they're quietly not objecting to an activist role for the court.
Okay. Well, I hate to say it, but we are out of time.
Okay,
it's been a delight talking with you today.
Well, thank you very much. I have thoroughly enjoyed this.
I've been speaking today with Eric Siegel, professor of law at Georgia State University. We've been discussing George Fletcher's book, Our Secret Constitution. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.